Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this Spotlight edition of the Future of Medicine podcast, I'll be joined by Dr. Lauren King. Dr. King is a licensed psychologist committed to helping individuals overcome their challenges. These may include eating disorders, body image concerns, anxiety, depression, or trauma. Lauren adopts a positive and optimistic approach. She focuses on her clients' strengths to instill confidence and help them achieve their objectives. She has a diverse professional background, including both outpatient settings as well as a partial hospitalization center for eating disorders. Lauren has over 15 years of private practice experience that have helped hone her skills and knowledge in this area. She and I both hope you enjoy the following conversation. Dr. King, thanks so much for joining us on this episode. As you know, I've been super excited to talk to you and really just gain from your wisdom and your experience. With the patients we work with here, we work with many individuals that either you would work directly with them or you might work with their children.
Yeah.
And so I know this is a pertinent topic to many. But as we get started, I just want to give you a chance to kind of introduce yourself a bit and really frame what led you into the field of psychology and what kind of led to that interest in now a thriving career.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to do this. But yeah, I'm a licensed psychologist and I'm the psych director over at a practice in Brentwood called Southeast Psych Nashville. And I mainly see women and girls and treat a lot of eating disorders, anxiety, OCD, that sort of thing. But really the way I got into the field actually was a journalism major in college, but I decided that I really wanted to do this when a really important mentor to me passed away. She died when I was a sophomore in college and her child died. And I was a pallbearer in the funeral for the baby. And it rocked me, man. It was really, really awful. And I think I just, in that moment, felt like, how do we get through this? Like, how do we do this? And I realized, like, it's each other. That's how we get through this. You know, I was at the funeral with all these other people who had loved her and loved her child. And I thought, like, that's how we get through hardship in life, really, is each other. And that's what really led me into the field of psychology, was like sitting with people in their pain is what's really, really powerful. And I want to be there for people in those tough moments.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I always love hearing someone's origin story. Mm-hmm. I know in my own story, I always come back to that, you know, when I get a little frustrated or get a little burned out.
Yeah.
And you come back to that origin story and it kind of gives you some fresh fire, which is really great.
Yeah. So, I actually don't know yours. What is the, what led you to medicine?
Yeah. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
You know, truly it goes back to my grandfather, primarily my mom's father, who my whole life struggled with heart disease. That was kind of what defined him was, you know, we were talking about either him going to the doctor or getting out of the hospital or visiting him in the hospital. And we would talk about his family doctor like he was just an extension of the family. You know, well, what did your doctor say? What did he recommend? What meds he have you on or whatever? And I remember being at a super young age, probably 7 or 8, and that just stuck with me. The influence that a family doc can have within the family unit and how vital it is for not only that individual, but for, in my grandfather's case, my grandmother and my mom and my uncle, and how the dynamics of that were so influenced by that person.
Yeah.
That was probably my original desire to be a family doc.
Love that.
Thanks. In your line of work, I know it's exceptionally hard when you're working with individuals who have hard stories, you know, very, very deep trauma or very real struggles. How do you manage your own emotional and mental health in that setting, especially when you're bombarded with challenging stories that as caregivers, as healthcare providers, we always have to walk that line of balancing, carrying that with us and not. How do you care for your own mental and emotional health?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like a lot of graduate school for psychologists is figuring out how to have a good emotional boundary between work and home, you know, and how to seek supervision and lean on colleagues if needed, and how to take care of yourself. And self-care looks different for everyone, you know. For me, it's like dancing in the kitchen with my kids and going on a walk and prayer. For somebody else, it might be totally different things, but identifying what are those things for you that keep your stress level low. The other part for me is being part of a group practice. Some people do great in practice alone. I would not do well in practice just by myself. Our team staffs cases together, seek support from each other. We have a very fun environment. We play games every week together as part of our staff meeting. And that's a way that we kind of do self-care, is like we have this heavy job, but we actually have a lot of fun and silliness together. And I think that helps me like more than I even know. I've been part of a group for 15 years. So, you know, I'm just really thankful for that.
That's great. Yeah. So it's kind of nice to have that community that cultivates that.
Right.
Not only as an individual.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah.
So to frame the next topic I want to go into, I want to kind of let you know how I think about, as adults, kind of our current health situation.
Yeah.
And this really includes physical health, but also emotional or mental health. And I just, I'm a very visual person, so I think and see in analogies and envision. But I think of a canyon, just a beautiful, beautiful canyon that has jagged edges, but it has nice and smooth surfaces. Has huge mountains, it has huge valleys, and it's been influenced by decades and years and years and years of influences, of the rain, of the wind, of other elements. And I think of that when I think of our current state as adults, where we look back into our health and we see the various influences that have led us to where we are. And I think in our hustle culture of sorts that we tend to almost get overwhelmed or hyper-focused on the outcome.
Yeah.
And we don't peel back and try to look at what led us to maybe these beliefs or these coping mechanisms. And to get your input, when I'm talking to our members, sometimes I'll really encourage them to get curious about their minds, you know, the why behind the action or the why behind the thought. How can therapy play a role in helping someone uncover some of those deeper influences?
Yeah, I think that therapy is hugely powerful in being able to help people understand the history about why they get sort of activated by certain things in life, right? But also it's helpful to move on, right? We're not just talking about your mother for a year, right? Like we are going to, that's sort of an older way of doing therapy. So yes, we want to understand the history. We want to understand what's making you anxious or sad or angry so that you can predict it. Because being able to predict something is really powerful. If every Sunday night I become incredibly anxious and I don't know why, you know, then that's scary. It feels like something must be wrong. If every time I'm with this person or I go here, I become anxious or scared, but I don't get why, then my brain is going to try to make sense of that and say, something must be wrong, something must be wrong. But if I can understand where it came from, make sense of it, validate myself, the intensity of the emotional reaction goes down, right? So when someone comes to therapy and just says, I don't even know what's wrong, I'm just so overwhelmed, I feel awful, what therapy can do is really map logic onto feeling and go, well, sadness is really about loss. Anger is about injustice. Anxiety is about threat. So what part of you is feeling threatened? What part of you is feeling like something's unfair? What are you feeling like you've lost? And for folks, like the way we cope as humans is we put words to what we feel. So if you can put words to it and make sense of it, man, that's fantastic, you know? And then the other part of therapy that I think really helps with what you're talking about is that the way we think about the world has a lot to do with how we feel about it, right? So if we've developed some core beliefs that are erroneous or unhelpful to us, I'm unloved, I'm unsafe, bad things happen to me, people leave me, whatever those thoughts are that we're sort of living out of, right? Therapy can help you really figure out what are some different ways to think about this situation, right? And then to feel differently and react differently out of that. I've got an example of my own. So when I first started running the practice in 2016 in Nashville, I was so stressed. I did not know how to run a business, right? I knew how to be a psychologist. And my business partner who's, you know, much more experienced than me, older than me, we were having lunch and I was like, our carpets are in the Indian Ocean and the phones don't work. We're never going to get the practice to open, you know, so stressed. And he goes, Lauren, you're going to burn out so fast if you react to every problem this way. You have to see every problem like an adventure. Like, ooh, this is interesting. Like, what am I going to do with this? This is a problem to be solved. This is fun, right? This is, and I was like, yeah, right? So that way of thinking, that was a mental shift for me that's been incredibly powerful for me as a leader. Yeah. I feel much more calm and confident. I'm excited by struggle. I expect obstacles. So just that little one shift in thinking for mm-hmm. me has meant the world. And that's really what therapy is filled with.
Yeah, that's great. Because I feel like oftentimes I run into individuals and even myself at times where I feel like I know enough. I should be able to solve this problem or mm-hmm. I should be able to overcome this emotion. But I love how you reframe it mm-hmm. and how your business partner recommended mm-hmm. like, hey, think of this problem as an adventure.
Yeah.
And even just that change in terminology mm-hmm. kind of unlocks all the possibilities.
Yeah. Like, how am I going to do this? But therapy, yeah. you can think about it kind of like a triangle. It's emotional expression, right? Putting words to what you feel. It's thoughts, so the cognitive distortions, like being able to identify those. What am I thinking that's not helpful and how yeah. can I change that? And then actions. What are things you can actually physically do to soothe yourself and address some of the kind of physiological reactions to what's going on emotionally?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. When I want to get into some of those kind of self-care and self-soothing mm. techniques in a bit. The next place I want to take our conversation is with really a pertinent topic in my practice. And you even brought it up when we were swapping kind of topic thoughts is the condition around health anxiety.
Yeah.
Really across a lot of ages. Mm-hmm. It's probably ageless when it comes to who I see struggling with levels of health anxiety. And it's a great challenge for me to be able to communicate at times to that setting because, and correct me if your experience is different, but I find often that health anxiety can often kind of represent a deeper anxiety mm-hmm. Where health may be the focus. And that may be part of the relief of the anxiety is being able to funnel all that anxiety to one area. But I see a challenge when a negative test result or an encouraging exam doesn't provide much, if any, relief.
Yeah.
How should I approach that as a primary care doc when I run into individuals really suffering from health anxiety?
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're so good at, and I've seen you do with shared clients that we've had or patients that we've had, is really empathize with it because it is incredibly painful, right, to go through something like that. And health anxiety frequently will spin up into health OCD, right? Sort of like a form of obsessive compulsive disorder where not only is there the obsessive worry and the physiological tension, right? But there's also a component of checking, like a compulsion of checking in with your doctor a lot, having lots, you know, more appointments maybe than your doctor would recommend or going online and reading lots of websites about what could be wrong with me, right, as a way to decrease anxiety, but it actually worsens anxiety over time. The checking worsens it.
Yeah.
And so being able to sort of get through those tough moments and tolerate, okay, I can't always know, right, my health. Like I can't always know everything going on in my body at every time. And so part of finding peace is being able to tolerate doubt, right? Mm-hmm. So I think really empathy and just saying like, this is what we know, this is what we don't know. And that person has got to find their way to get through those tough moments of doubt. And that is different for everybody, right? That is kind of, it's not going to be the same for me as it is for someone else, but they have to be willing to try lots of things and see what's working. And if they're not able to figure it out on their own, I think that is maybe when a referral to a mental health professional could be helpful to say, you know, maybe talking to somebody and figuring out, is at the core of this a fear of death? Is this actually that you're really anxious about this thing over here that you don't have control over, but you feel like you could control this? I mean, so I think a referral would probably be appropriate at that point if they're just not able to figure out why or to help themselves feel better.
Yeah, yeah. No, well said. And what are ways that, and I don't want to hyper focus on that thought too much of health anxiety, but I think it really transitions into some of the self-care management of anxiety, generalized anxiety. Mm-hmm. What are some techniques or ways that you can recommend people to kind of turn down the speed of their mind and to calm their mind when they might be tempted to go through that OCD type thought of, okay, I need to go online or I need to reach out to the doctor, I need to get this test done. How do you recommend they kind of calm themselves and self-soothe of sorts?
Yeah, I would mention two things to start in terms of that racing thought, the kind of ruminating thought. Yeah. I think two things that are helpful. One is mindfulness, and all mindfulness is paying attention to the present moment on purpose without judging it. Mm-hmm. So we tend to time travel forward a lot or backward in time, right? So we're thinking, what if this happens or this or this? Or remember last week when this happened in my body and I felt, you know, so really just being in the present moment and just describing it in your own mind and observing it without judgment. Practicing that starting for even just 1 minute at a time. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness has a whole host of positive outcomes with it. When psychologists first started studying mindfulness, I was actually pretty annoyed because they were really excited about it. And at every conference I went to, they were like, we're going to mindfully eat. We're going to mindfully. They were doing all these practices and it was kind of driving me crazy. But the research on it actually is good. Schools are doing it with kids because it improves focus, it lowers anxiety. Yeah. And there's a ton of online apps and stuff too that will lead you through mindfulness practices. Yeah. So mindfulness is huge. The other thing I think can be helpful is something called radical acceptance. Radical acceptance is the idea that you radically accept the present moment without wishing it were different, like body, mind, and spirit. So if you think about COVID, right? A lot of us in the beginning were really like, I wish it were different. I wish it were different. Why can't this be different? What can we do to make it go away? So angry, so anxious. Yeah. And we sort of had to go, you know what? It is what it is. I don't like it. Radical acceptance doesn't mean that you like it. If you have a chronic health condition, you don't like that. But radical acceptance is, this is what it is. This is the hand of cards I was dealt. And so in light of that, how am I going to live my life, right? Mm-hmm. So with health anxiety, if we apply it, right? During COVID, I said to a lot of my teenagers, yeah, you can't see your friends. This is really hard. You're all isolated, alone, and you're scared. So we don't like that, but it is what it is right now. So in light of that, how are you going to live your life? This is going to be a story you tell your grandchildren.
Yeah.
So like, is this going to be the time you learned guitar? Is this going to be the time that you wrote your own book? Like, well, I don't know what that's going to look like for you. Mm-hmm. And so with people with health anxiety saying that doubt, that unknown is there. That is part of the human condition.
Yeah.
And so in light of that, how are you still going to live your life in a way that's meaningful to you and that you're passionate about and really focusing on those values?
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I'm glad you took me down the mindfulness route because personally, I'm a huge proponent of that, believer in it. But at times, truly, as a healthcare provider, I feel like it seems so simple to talk about, you know, just being in the moment, maybe focusing on your breath and getting feedback from your body. It seems so simple with all the technologies and medications and interventions and therapy techniques that
That's
you
true.
Have. It seems so simple.
Yeah.
But sometimes the solution to a problem is the most obvious one. And it's the one right there. And I think it's so empowering to be able to encourage and teach people the mindfulness thought process because it's always accessible. You know, you can do it while you're driving. You know, your eyes don't have to be closed. Like you can do it while you're driving. You can do it here in a room. You can do it when you're in a fight with the kids. You know, it's like at any moment you can introduce mindfulness, but I find that it often doesn't introduce itself. You have to welcome it in.
And you have to practice it.
And practice.
Because in a moment of distress, you're not going to turn to it unless you've practiced it, almost over practiced it. So you have to practice in moments of being calm so that when you're in distress, you can access it easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great insights. Thanks so much. The next place I want to take our topic, and all these I think kind of layer on each other, but have just subtle different headings of sorts. But here at Brentwood MD, we work with a lot of young individuals whose careers are kind of heading up and to the right.
Yeah.
Very busy. Maybe a lot of travel, a lot of pressure, and a lot of stress. And I think that's really a common experience for anywhere from young adults to really any age has that kind of philosophy of achievement. And whether this is professional achievement or family achievement, you know, being the caregiver, the organizer of the house and the activities, there's a lot of pressure and stress. Sometimes I see that be to the detriment of their own mental and physical health. It'll almost be like they shove it off to the side knowing like I'm ignoring my own health for the sake of something good.
Yeah.
You know, I'm my kids are a great example with parenting. I feel like is maybe a mother or father ignore their own health because they're more focused on their children, getting mm-hmm. them to the right activities, putting them in the position for mm-hmm. success. How do you encourage individuals with a lot of different demands, either yeah. personal or professional, find more balance and mm. not neglect their own mental or physical health?
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes we'll share the studies on how much stress impacts health, right? Yeah. How much health can impact productivity, right? Like mm-hmm. when we're stressed for that long, our systems become depressed. And we all know that depression is not exactly a great place to be functioning out of. We're not going to yeah. do our best work from that kind of place. And so to just share, this is what this looks like if it continues. You want to be productive, but if you don't start taking care of yourself and making some tough choices, your performance is also going to struggle, mm-hmm. not just your health.
Yeah.
But also, we do know from the research that children with parents who are stressed and anxious are more stressed and anxious themselves. They pick up on so much. There are things that are passed along from parents to children, just non-verbally, right? Mm-hmm. Even if a parent is not talking about their stress, their child is feeling it. And so you may think you're hiding it or, you yeah. know, whatever, yeah. but you probably aren't. You're probably transmitting stress to them. And so I think for a lot of people, when they hear that, that is motivating enough to say, okay, can I just take one step? I don't have to retool my whole life. But if I can just do a very simple task and write down all my have-tos, right? Pay the bills, go to work, travel, go to the kids' soccer, you know, all the things I'm doing. I'm volunteering, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I'm on this extra committee at work, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
What's life giving in your life and what's life sucking, you know? And mm-hmm. what, if you can just take one thing off the life sucking list, that will be huge. Some things you can't take off. You can't take work off the list, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You just can't. But there are probably some things you could do that you could take action on and de-stress. And I think part of that too is shifting thinking from a place of perfectionism, that I have to be perfect in my role.
Yeah.
Right? Because that is, you know, we're putting like a lot of pressure on the way you think about your job or dreading it a lot. You know, that can really impact stress. But if you, for example, just go, well, I got a 2-hour meeting and I'm dreading it, you know, sort of in your mind being like, well, I'm going to consider it emotionally. Like if someone told me you got to go rake leaves for 2 hours, I'd be like, I mean, I don't really want to, but I can rake leaves for 2 hours. There's all the emotional push and stress around it and perfectionism, yeah. right? So yeah. kind of trying to consider work, like it's just a thing to do and I'm already good at it. I have the job. So part of it, I think, is really deciding how you're going to shift the way you spend your time. But part of it is shifting how you're thinking about your job as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you took me to a place that I wanted to go mm-hmm. in that conversation where really the dynamic between the parent and child mm-hmm. and like you were referencing kind of anxious parents, you see anxious children. Mm-hmm. And I know in my own home and in the members that I treat here, there's this real stress to break that cycle, mm-hmm. you know, to be struggling with anxiety, but not, you know, stop the wheel.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, you don't want to pass that on, mm-hmm. but that can become overwhelming and actually its own source of anxiety because you're so worried about the perfectionism of kind of controlling your anxiety so it's not passed down.
Yeah.
How do you recommend parents kind of approach that through yeah. their own struggles, but also recognizing how their struggles do influence their families?
Right. I do think parents right now feel like they have to be perfect. Yeah. I mean, everywhere they look, on Instagram, online, through the school, whatever, there's more tips on how to be a better parent and how you should be parenting.
Yeah.
And it really is exhausting. I think they just feel an enormous pressure that like they're gonna make this misstep. But there's this concept in psychology called the good enough mother, right? That the healthiest child just has a mother who's good enough.
Yeah.
You don't have to be perfect. In fact, it's good for your kids if you mess up sometimes because like they become more hardy people, yeah. right? If we make their little life perfect and we rescue them all the time, that's not great either. We want to do our best for them. But we have to know we're not going to be perfect.
Yeah.
Just sort of this idea that I just need to be good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you may be touching on a bit of the thought too, where I feel like parents today struggle with being the parent or being the friend.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to be labeled really too far on either extreme, and it's really hard to find the balance. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that kind of goes along with that line of thinking where it's like, I want my kids to have such a different experience. I'm just going to be totally different and maybe err on the side of being maybe a little more friend to your child than the parent that they need. Do you run into that in your practice?
Yeah, I think like most things culturally, we like swing the pendulum, right? Yeah. So from authoritarian to like very laissez-faire, permissive, yeah, right? And there's like this very gentle parenting movement, which has some, I think, good parts of it, as long as it's paired with consequences and discipline, right? Mm-hmm. That like there still is. So the best parenting style really is warm but firm. Right. So my parents were really strict on me. I'm going to have no rules is too far of a swing, you know. Yeah. So going, yeah, we're still going to have rules and limits. Respect's not an option in the house. But I do want you to have opinions. I want you to share your feelings with me. You can absolutely disagree with me. Like all that is good. And I'm going to be warm with you in my interactions with you. But I'm also going to set limits and you're going to know who's in charge. Mm-hmm. That's really where you want to land as a parent. That has the best kind of outcomes for kids, not only academically and in their jobs, but in the health of their relationships and their own emotional health too.
Yeah, yeah. What are some maybe common well-intentioned mistakes that you see parents make? I feel like parents in general, of course, we want to do our best. But what are kind of two to three things that you see maybe in your practice that you feel like, oh, that means so well, but the outcome of that action or inaction can be harmful.
I feel like the biggest one is rescuing, like not letting kids fail or be independent, like try independence in a way.
Yeah.
And I think we're scared generationally as parents because the way the news cycle is and social media, we actually feel that the world is much more dangerous than it is in a lot of ways. And, you know, for example, this summer, I let my kid, my 10-year-old, ride her bike. They did what's called a bike bus through our neighborhood. So she would start the bike bus and she would pick up little girls all the way to swim practice. So there were like 12 of them by the time they got there. And they would go to swim practice and then they would ride their bikes back and they would drop each other off at their houses on the way back. I was so anxious the first day. I felt like I had sent her to slaughter. Like I was like, she's gonna be kidnapped. And I knew I needed to do this. Like I knew. Yeah. I need to let her be independent. It's okay to do this. She's 10 years old. She's going to be with 12 other kids. Like, this is fine, you know? But I felt so nervous. And I think a lot of parents feel that way. Or we feel like, gosh, there's all this pressure to get into college. And it's so hard to get into college. So we can't let our kids take the harder class or they might get the lower grade, even though that might be more challenging and a better learning experience for them.
Yeah.
Because we're aware of like the GPA they have to have and the ACT score they have to have. We're just so tuned in to the pressures of our world that it's hard to relax, you know? And so we end up rescuing. And I think we've got to stop ourselves from that.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. You know?
Yeah.
I think I've heard your presentations before where you talk about even that thought of letting your kids play outside. Mm-hmm. And there's this caution around the neighbors and the people, mm-hmm. you know, who could take my child. Mm-hmm. And statistics, I think you've said, are like so far down from mm-hmm. where they used to be in terms of kidnappings and such. And
right.
of course, you want to be aware of your surroundings, but you can't let that pendulum swing too far where overprotection, isolation is the outcome.
Because you want to raise a child who can navigate difficult situations and, you know, isn't afraid to be independent and isn't afraid to fail.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I do think the perfectionism thing would be my other answer, like trying to feel like they have to be perfect as a parent. And sometimes parental guilt, you know, especially when I see kids with eating disorders, the parents come in and they just are like, I caused this. I know I caused it. I feel so awful.
Yeah.
And really the research doesn't bear that out. The parents are the thing that causes eating disorders, you know? And so there's this metaphor in emotionally focused family therapy where they talk about the good house and the bad house. Are you operating out of the good house as a parent? Or are you operating out of the bad house?
Yeah.
And the good house is really, I believe I'm capable of good for my child over time and space. I know that I'm not perfect. I know that I make mistakes and that when I make those, I can make really good repairs with my kid. Mm-hmm. The bad house is a place of insecurity. I do things wrong. I'm not good for my kid. I'm not the right fit. Somebody could do it better.
Yeah.
Those outcomes are going to be really poor. because you just have to kind of go, hey, I'm not perfect, but I forgive myself. I seek forgiveness for my child. And then I'm going to move on operating out of that good house that I am capable of good over time for my child.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are really beautiful thoughts. And I feel like as I look back, I'm 41 now, and as I look back at my own experience and kind of even go back to that Canyon thought of, okay, what led me to where I am here, and what was good and what was bad and what was beautiful and what was ugly. I wish I'd failed more. You know, I think we learn, and I don't know if this is true, but I feel like I learn more from my failures than I do my successes, which is so counterintuitive to one's life story where, you know, if you want to become a physician, you got to work really hard, do really well on all the tests, get into the good schools, pass those tests and more tests, and you got to take care of people and do well. Where in reality, I look back and go, man, if I could only have failed a little earlier in life, I think I would be stronger now.
Yeah.
And then as a parent, you kind of look at that and I'm like, well, okay, how can I take that knowledge at 41 and look at my 8-year-old or my 10-year-old and let them fail?
Right. And it's so painful. So of course you want to avoid that, you know, because it's painful.
But you know, you it's that tension of like knowing that that will be true of them too, where they need to look back at their own failures, but it's so hard to let your child fail, even encourage failure.
Yeah.
Can be a challenge. Right. So thanks for reviewing
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah.
You touched in your last thought on one thing that I do want to dive into, and I know you have great expertise in this, and it's around eating disorders. And really, not thinking of any particular age or any particular disorder, how would you recommend we cultivate a healthy relationship with nutrition and with food? Because I see those challenges across all ages, you know, whether it's working with someone in their 50s and 60s who've carried too much weight for years, or in some of the challenges of body image and self-worth in a younger individual. How do we develop a good, healthy relationship with food at any age?
Well, it's not easy because the culture we live in, right? We're all swimming in this same sort of dirty water of diet culture and, you know, sort of maybe ads for a big juicy cheeseburger right next to, you know, an ad of a woman who's been airbrushed to death and looks very underweight. And this is the ideal body you should have, right? But this is how you should be eating. And these very sort of like mixed messages. And I think right now we're living in a time where there are a lot of diets that don't call themselves diets. We're like obsessed with the idea of clean eating and to a point where it's making people so anxious. They feel like they cannot ever eat the right thing. And so just thinking really like the goal is eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full, and move your body. Sounds simple. But it's not, because we hear all these voices and all this pressure, right? And for some people, there's really emotionally loaded parts of this. If they went through something difficult when they were young and food was the only way they had to cope, they used food as a way to cope, right? Or they went through something really difficult and they felt out of control and the only thing they control was not eating, right? There's something very loaded for them about it. But I think in children, just not over educating kids, not over talking about it, right? Just teaching you need to kind of get in all your food groups and that's it, you know? Food is just food, and it should be enjoyable too. Like, we've used food to celebrate for centuries and we should be able to celebrate. And then I think the other piece is teaching kids about body diversity, that there really are a lot of different body types out there, and that's fine, right? We don't expect a wiener dog to look like a Labrador. We don't expect a pug to look like a bull mastiff, right? We don't expect a whippet to look like a doodle. Like, dogs have all different kind of body types and humans do too, and that's okay. And you can be in a little bit bigger body and be healthy, like, you know, I mean, and actually be healthier than someone in a small body. That isn't necessarily the one defining thing about health, is the weight. It's not the only thing, right? And so helping kids understand your body may look a little different from hers, but that's okay. Body acceptance actually can lead to more food freedom, right? When kids feel like foods are bad or off limits, they're more compulsive about them. They eat them more frequently, right? Or if they feel like I need to force my body into this one size and I can't accept it as it is, they're actually more likely to overeat or undereat.
When I think that thought is so true across all ages, where like when you restrict yourself from something, there's the drive to have more of it. And it's that imbalance of like, oh, I can't have this. So if you ever kind of fall off the proverbial wagon, you overindulge in that.
Yes.
And it almost isolates things too much from being healthy and being unhealthy, where then you run into guilt, you run into depression, you run into a lot of emotions that are then connected to your actions around your food.
Yeah.
And disconnecting some of that is a challenge. Mm-hmm. But I see that, like you referenced in children, you want to make sure you kind of navigate that appropriately. But I see it in adults where the over-restriction becomes a problem.
Right. I'm not having any sugar. I'm not having any, right? And so then ultimately your body's craving that and wants that even more, instead of going, I can, you know, I'm going to have a treat a couple times a week. That's fine, right? Yeah. This sort of more balanced view, but that's harder for us oftentimes. Yeah. And so we just completely will cut out entire food groups or not be getting enough sort of just caloric intake, not nourishing ourselves enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm big, and when it comes to working with my patients, big on balance, you know, not feeling like we have to over-exalt or over-depress one area of our nutrition, but find the right balance. And just like therapy is so beautiful in working with individuals and going through their story and their unique path, there's such value to that with any patient, to work with them, because everybody's story, there may be common themes, but everyone's story is unique and
there's
unique challenges.
Yeah.
I love working in my practice with husbands and wives and seeing them be challenged in different ways.
Yeah.
And maybe even making recommendations for one but not the other, because it's right for them but not the other. And the dynamic there, where I think we, especially in the setting of a close relationship, we default to thinking like, well, we should do the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this, there has to be just one rule.
It's
more complicated than that.
Right.
But also more freeing than that, where like you say, some of the definitions we have of good health aren't one size fits all. Mm-hmm. There's health at many sizes and many body types.
Right. Right.
Beautiful thought. Along with eating disorders, kind of taking it from the mindset of a parent concerned about their child.
Yeah.
What should that thought process look like? If a parent is concerned that their child may have a type of eating disorder or just an unhealthy relationship with food or self-confidence and image, what should that their first steps be as a parent?
Yeah, I would say really the best course of action is to start with their medical doctor or a psychologist who specializes in eating disorders or a therapist who specializes in eating disorders. If it is an eating disorder, really what's recommended is to have a registered dietitian, a medical doctor, and a therapist who specializes in eating disorders all on your team, you know, to have sort of a team of three following the child, because recovery from an eating disorder really does take a team approach. There needs to be someone monitoring the child medically, telling you really like what do they need to eat to re-nourish themselves, and then there's sort of the emotional side of that. But I would say before doing that, really approaching the child lovingly with evidence is so important, right? Not just being like, you've got a problem with food, what's your deal, you know, but hey, I noticed you haven't eaten dinner with us the last three nights, or I heard you vomiting outside the bathroom or whatever it is. I love you, I'm really worried about you, let's go get some help. Eating disorders are unlikely to get better on their own. There are some things, right? We all have transient worry. We all have transient, you know, there are some things that do kind of like, you can get through it with your community and on your own. Eating disorders tend to really need professional help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great insight too. That, like you say, they don't typically get better on their own.
Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective, where at any point along the struggle, intervention is necessary, and the sooner the better,
because the longer you're sick with an eating disorder, the worse your outcome, or the worse your likelihood of full recovery is.
Yeah.
So if you seek treatment earlier, it's better.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I know that'll be encouraging to many of our listeners, either through their own personal story, continued struggles in adult, or if they are indeed parents of kids that are struggling.
Yeah.
Shifting gears a little bit more toward your practice and what you're excited about. So tell me a little bit more about what you may be excited on, either at Southeast Psych or just in psychology in general, that may be on the horizon that gives you a lot of energy around your work.
Yeah. So we've got a few new clinicians on board who I'm really excited about. Hannah Deschner, who treats trauma. She's trained in EMDR. And Rachel Holloway, who works more with substance use and kind of adolescents who are have sort of a lot of emotional volatility. They're great. Yeah. We also just hired our very first executive functioning coach, which I'm really excited about. Okay. So she works with fifth grade through college. Anybody who's having trouble with organization, task completion, writing a paper. This is not like content tutoring. It's not chemistry. You might do your chemistry homework in the course of it, right? But it's really learning how to learn. And she was full the very first week. People were so excited.
Might need an appointment. That's with her right.
So that's going really well. And I'm very excited about that. And we've also brought back groups again. You know, during COVID, all our group therapy went away.
Yeah.
And we actually have had a really hard time bringing it back until really like this past spring. So right now we're running a group. Rachel Holloway, actually, who I mentioned, is running a group for teen girls with anxiety that filled up really quickly. And we've got another one coming in the spring. So I'm excited to bring back group therapy again. And in terms of what I'm excited about in psychology is I really am trained in something called family-based treatment for eating disorders. So it's parents refeeding their children at home. It's for children who are living at home and have anorexia. It also has been used with bulimia as well, but it's a pretty manualized treatment, and it puts a parent in charge of refeeding, and then slowly you're giving back food decisions to the child over time instead of them having to go to a hospital. Obviously, sometimes a hospital is medically necessary, but what FBT does is it tries to keep the child at home so they don't have to do that. So that's what I'm trained in. But really what's been brought into FBT is something called emotionally focused family therapy. It's not just how to do this, but how can you emotionally support your child? It has a lot of tips on how to do the emotional coaching, the food coaching with parents. It's not just like a step by step, but when your child does this, how can you react kind of emotionally? So I've been loving that and loving reading about it. There's something else I'm really interested in and have started getting trained in called Radically Open DBT. You've probably heard of dialectical behavior therapy, DBT. Mm-hmm. It's for borderline personality disorder, but it's also for any issue of like emotional dysregulation, right? Mm-hmm. Where someone might do something to hurt themselves as a way to control their feelings, self-harm, threaten to self-harm, suicide attempts, it could be eating disorder behaviors, lots of things. But what I deal with mostly with anorexia is over control. It's not under control, right? It is over controlled, tightly wound, very black and white, rigid thinking. And radically open DBT is actually to help with that. So people who have OCD, treatment resistant depression, and like anorexia is really what that's for. And so I'm very excited about getting trained in that.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, tell our listeners a little more how they can get in touch with you and your partners at Southeast Psych.
Great. So you can always call 615-373-9955 is our number and speak to one of our lovely intake coordinators. They know all the therapists, their specialties. They're great at matching therapists with clients. So you can call, you can also go on our website, southeastpsychnashville.com, and fill out a getting started form, and they'll call you or email you back from that.
Yeah.
And then anyone's welcome to email me, you know, if you hear this podcast and have further questions. My email's on our website, but it's L as in Lauren, L King at southeastpsych.com.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, one thing your practice has always done so well is through that kind of intake coordinator, where they hear a little bit of the story and then they can connect someone with someone that has either that training or that interest.
Yeah.
Do you have any other, for individuals that are outside of your practice, any tips for finding a compatible therapist? You know, I think so many people, like many things, if you want to find a restaurant, you go to Google.
Yeah.
And if you want to find a therapist, you might still go to Google. Mm-hmm. How can you identify somebody that you may be more compatible with than others?
Right.
Do you have any recommendations around that?
Yeah, you want someone licensed, certainly, right? Someone who specializes in the area that you're struggling with. But the biggest thing that we see, you know, there's tons of research studies, meta-analyses about what type of therapy works best, you know, how effective is each therapy type. But the most important factor, no matter what type of therapy you're using, is client-therapist fit. How much does the client rate the therapist fit? And so I would recommend, so at our practice, and a lot of practices do this, not just us, but I like a 15-minute meet and greet. And they might come and meet with two or three therapists. And really, that's their time to interview us, get a sense of our personality, how we connect with them. Just see who do you really connect with and feel comfortable with, because that is actually the one factor that matters the most in terms of how you're going to get better. If you meet with the person and think, I didn't enjoy them, they made me feel weird. That's not going to be a great fit.
Yeah. Mm. Is that a fair ask when people reach out to a therapist? It's, hey, before we sign up for a session, can I have a meet and greet?
Could I chat on the phone with you a little bit? Something like that. I think that's great. Even if you just, you do an intake and you don't see it going anywhere, then I would say it's okay to kind of bow out. But fit really is the most important thing.
I didn't obviously know the stats behind that and the thought, but it just seems so obvious. And sometimes I'll talk to patients who may come to me and they, I think pertinent to this conversation is they'll tell me, oh, I've done therapy before, or I've had therapy before, maybe a not as great experience or a negative experience. And you dive a little deeper into their prior experience and they just never felt that connection.
Yeah.
They never felt like that client-patient relation, or that patient-therapist relationship was strong. Mm-hmm. And that becomes kind of a little wound that they carry. And so then working to introduce them to another therapist. I'm blessed, obviously, to know you, many of your colleagues, and then other practices in town where I can feel real confident through my relationship with the patient to say, hey, I think this person would be good for you. Give them a try. And maybe, obviously, reinstitute therapy into their health plan. So.
Yeah, that can be hard when someone's built a negative association with therapy. Yeah. But that's why I think sometimes those little brief meetings are maybe not as intimidating, but can give them information and also freedom that you're not stuck with this person just because you met with them once, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for your time and sharing tons of wisdom. I think we could have probably spent 45 minutes going over each topic individually. Yeah. So thanks for doing a bit of an overview, a shallow dive into multiple areas. But thanks again for your time. I know this has been valuable.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.